All right, the second case this morning is Aiken and Cerro versus McKelvey.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Eric Lewis on behalf of appellants.
Did you wish to reserve any time
for rebuttal? Yes, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
3 minutes.
If the court has any specific questions, I'm happy to address those now. Otherwise, I'll just run through the issues on appeal. The first issue on appeal is whether or not the trial court erred when it concluded that it was a question of fact whether or not Ms. Aiken was a business visitor or a social guest at the time of this incident. Now,
your position on that issue is that the mere fact that there was a purchase of this cream is sufficient to establish her as a business invitee as opposed to a licensee?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
And you rely on McKinnon for that?
That's correct. So McKinnon and the restatement 332, which was cited in McKinnon.
In McKinnon, they stated the rule that it must be shown that the business or purpose for which the visitor comes upon the premises is of actual or potential benefit to the owner or occupier thereof. And that, you argue that, I mean, I don't think that's your argument, is it?
That it was of economic benefit to her? That's incorporating the rule from Dodson. Now, Dodson was the economic benefit test, and Dodson was in 1955. McKinnon came out in 1966 and adopted the restatement from 1965.
But in McKinnon, they stated the rule and indicated that that was their longstanding economic benefit test and that was not changed.
So that's true, but in McKinnon, they also said this is not the sole criteria on which to determine whether or not someone is, in fact, a business visitor. So,
That's because they adopted the public invitee test as well. But that's the public invitee test is not at issue here. The only test at issue here is whether or not she was a business invitee. And under that test, as stated in McKinnon, the question is whether there's some economic benefit to the possessor of the property.
Yeah, that's correct. Which there was here. There was a business transaction
here.
Well, the benefit was that
the economic benefit to the possessor of the property.
I think that the court's question sort of interprets that very narrowly. You're suggesting that only in the event that the owner of the residence actually incurs some sort of financial benefit, that alone would be. I'm sorry.
Isn't that the economic test?
No, I don't believe it is. I'm sorry. So in Dodson, the rule is we have defined an invitee to be one who is either expressly or impliedly invited onto the premises of another for some purpose connected with the business in which the owner or occupant is then engaged. And to establish some such relationship, there must be some real or supposed mutuality of interest. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is mutuality of interest. In this particular instance, and this is the language, the rule cited from Dodson. In this particular instance, the benefit to Ms. Aiken was that she was selling a product that she sells through her employment, and that's part of her job description.
Is there a case you're relying on for where the situation is reversed as it is here? It's not the possessor of the property who gets the economic benefit, but it's actually the visitor that gets the economic benefit. Is there some case like that?
I don't have a citation to a specific case where those facts are present. Nevertheless, I think the mutuality of the test is what's important here, and there's a mutual benefit. In addition, under the rule in McKinnon, the actual test for whether a business visitor or whether a person qualifies as a business visitor was actually expanded. And in the restatement and in McKinnon, it reads that the person who, in this case, Ms. Aiken, was invited to enter onto the land for a purpose directly or indirectly connected with business dealings. So defendant's argument on summary judgment and in this in their briefing to this court has been that that the primary purpose or the original purpose of Ms. Aiken's trip was, in fact, social, not business. And under the rule stated in McKinnon, this court doesn't look at, or the trial court should not have looked at, the primary purpose of the or the original purpose, because
aren't there a number of cases though that talk about whether or not the business purpose is incidental to the main purpose of the visit?
I'm not aware of any, and though there are cases that have held that even where someone's the business is incidental to the original purpose, and I'm sorry, the case is escaping me, that it's still to be determined by the court whether or not that's sufficient to create the status of a business visitor. The second issue that we've addressed here is that the question of whether Ms. Aiken breached her duty by turning around facing backward, the fact that she saw or believed that the step represented a dangerous condition prior to going through it, and that she admitted in her testimony that had she been facing forward, she thought it was likely that she wouldn't fall. That was sufficient for the trial court to hold that as a matter of law, or rather as a question of fact, reasonable people could only come to one conclusion, that Ms. Aiken's negligence was the sole proximate cause of her harm. Smith v. Manning is directly on point on this issue.
Let me back you up on that issue, though. Coming back to the first test, how would we expect the McIntyres to know that there was a danger or recognize a danger on their property? How would they know that somebody would go through their gate backwards and step off the step?
Well,
how would you recognize that?
What I was thinking about is this. Any time that I watch someone else open a door for anyone, or I do it myself, it's often the case that you open the door, you step back to allow the person to either enter or exit. And if the standard of care, if there is an affirmative duty to look behind you before you step as you're pushing open a door or opening a door for someone else, I'm not aware of it, and no case has ever cited that.
But what about the affirmative duty? Where's the duty, though, for the landowner to recognize that that's going to happen? And make sure their house is built today.
Well, in this particular instance, Mr. McElvey enjoys sort of a unique position. He was the general contractor on the project.
Do we hold him to a higher standard for that?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe when, if, for example, in legal malpractice cases where an attorney is practicing in an area, has a special expertise in an area, he's held to a higher standard. I believe the same would be true here.
All right, you'll have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. Kathleen Thompson for the defendants. We brought this motion because we felt that there were no genuine issues of material fact with respect to the plaintiffs being able to prove their case.
Let me ask you about, would it not be a jury question, the degree of fault of the appellant here? I mean, theoretically, it's a comparative negligence statute, so they could award 1% fault to the homeowner and 99% to the plaintiff, yet she would still be entitled to a judgment, right? So I'm trying to figure out how they got to sole, that it was the sole proximate cause.
This is a situation where to be honest, it's perplexing that it was even brought in the first place because we've got a plaintiff who has admitted, essentially, I wasn't paying attention and I stepped backwards and fell. And if you hadn't been talking to me, I wouldn't have fallen. I wouldn't have been stepping backwards. So I don't see there's even any question there. There's no unreasonable condition. This is a single step. They have not shown with any evidence by any code with any expert that this that single steps are not allowed, that it violated any codes.
But they had an expert that said it could have been designed to better standards, right? Doesn't that make it a jury question?
I would not consider that an expert. Actually, I would not consider those to be, and the trial court did not either consider Mr. Baird's opinions to be expert opinions. They were not.
Did the trial court consider the opinions and then disregard? Isn't that weighing the evidence?
I believe that what the trial court said was, Judge Middow said, I'm not striking this declaration. However, the rules of law state that in order for an expert opinion to create a genuine issue of material fact, it has to be more than conclusory opinions.
Well, but
and
he did set out the standard. He went out there and measured the property. He took pictures, set out the standard from the ASTM, and then reached opinions. How is that conclusory?
The ASTM is not a standard. It is not a nationally recognized standard in the nation or in Seattle. It's not been adopted as a code.
It's not a code, but it is a recognized standard for engineers to follow.
But I don't believe there was anything in that standard that stated that they could not have a single step there.
But it did say that if you have a single step, you should use a railing or mark it. And wouldn't a railing, if she stepped back, wouldn't a railing have stopped her from going off?
I don't believe there's any requirement in there for a railing. No, I don't believe there was any requirement for any railing.
Didn't it recommend railings or markings if you have a single step?
No. I don't believe so, Your Honor, no. Which is why our expert said, even if it were applicable, it doesn't call for a railing for a single step. In addition to that, if she is arguing that had a railing been there, there's no requirement for a railing, not even with the ASTM, what good would have done? Would that have been the cause of her fall? No, because if there had been a railing there, she wasn't even paying attention to any railing. She was stepping backwards and talking. So I don't see how any railing would be relevant.
But here you've got the edge of the step is an inch and a half beyond the edge of the door. It's right there. The door opens, and you're right at the edge of the step. If there had been a railing there, she wouldn't have fallen off.
That's speculation. And she did not say in her deposition testimony when I asked her what was the reason for your fall, she didn't say because there was no railing and I tried to reach out and I started falling. She said I was stepping backwards because she was talking to me. So that, to me, makes the issue of a railing moot.
Doesn't it actually just raise a question for the jury?
I don't believe so. I think that's essentially our arguments. We don't believe there are any genuine issues of material fact here, and that the court's ruling should be affirmed. Thank you.
Before you sit down, did you want to address the status of the invitee?
Yes, I'm sorry, I do. We had argued that she was a social guest, and that was because the argument was there was no economic benefit or business benefit. There was no business that she was going to the premises for. She was a friend of my client. My client was someone who got facials from her, but it was clear from the text messages that were sent between the two that she offered to come and visit her, and she texted her and said, hey, can I still come over? And my client said, that would be great. And then she said something about, what do you recommend about scar treatment? And Ms. Aiken said, well, I recommend this and such. Do you want me to bring you some? That would be great. And she brought her some. She visited. She stayed for 30 minutes. She visited she met the family. She had coffee. They talked. That was the extent of the visit. But what I argued in response to their opposition that, you know, this motion should be denied because she was a business visitor was that either way, I didn't concede that she was a business visitor. My argument was either way, it doesn't matter. There was no breach of any duty of care to her. This was not an unreasonably dangerous condition, and the judge agreed with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm sorry, I'll pick up, I guess, where I with respect to the, you had asked Respondent's Counsel about the exclusion of plaintiff's expert witness. And I don't believe the trial court's decision isn't clear. It's not clear whether the court struck it or simply just disregarded it.
But our review is de novo, so we can review it.
That's correct. And I think in this particular instance, given all of the information that the curriculum vitae, his experience testifying as an expert witness, et cetera, I didn't see any conclusory statements in there. He simply offered opinions. Now, we don't have to prove that but for a railing or some sort of visual marking on the edge of the step, this accident wouldn't have happened. That's not plaintiff's burden of proof in this case. We're actually just trying to prove that those were things that could have made the step more safe. It is speculative to say that those would have prevented the harm. Nevertheless, they could have been done to make the step more safe, and that wasn't done. And that would be evidence of negligence and breach of the standard of care.
We'll come back, though. Why would the defendants be expected to know ASTM manual might be out there?
In this particular instance, again, because Mr. McElvey is employed as a general contractor, this is his business. He hired the architect who
testified he'd never heard of the manual.
I'm sorry?
Didn't he testify he'd never heard of the ASTM?
He may have, and he would put his credibility at issue in that particular respect. That would be very surprising. I've heard of it. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a general contractor. I would assume that he would at least be familiar with it, in addition to which, as a general contractor, he would be familiar not just with the rules that from the Seattle Building Code or the Seattle Residential Code, but he would also be familiar with the standard of care of a particular thing. So when you build a single step, what's the sort of applicable standard of care? Defendants had argued at the motion for summary judgment that there was no standard, which would essentially be the argument that, well, he could have built anything he wanted out there.
Was he asked about that on deposition, about standard of care and his familiarity or lack of familiarity with it?
I don't recall. I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Isn't it a reasonable person test, though? Aren't we looking at what a reasonable landowner would do? Look at, I mean, you know, again, coming back to how are they going to discover that there's a problem with that step?
Well, here's what I come out with. It, basically, in the case, sorry, pardon me for just a moment. I believe it's Dieter, talks about the duty of a landowner. And it says...
You can finish your answer.
All right. Basically that person who enters the land is entitled to expect such care not only in the original construction of the premises and any activities of the possessor or his employees, which may affect those conditions, but also an inspection to discover the actual condition and any latent defects, followed by such repair safeguards or warnings as may be reasonably necessary for the protection under the circumstances.
Thank
and
you.
That is Deagle v. Majestic Mobile Manor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.